Exactly.
Yeah, this is how we're taping it.
Okay. As always, if you've got a cell phone, turn it off. And if it goes off, give us a show. You know, it's like, oh, well, I'll go deliver the child now. And off you go, and, you know, then we'll forgive you for that. Yeah, I got to do something. And also, I've been asked to announce that they will be putting away all the books and stuff like that at about 6:15, at 6:15. So if you want to look at anything or something, best sooner rather than later, lest like the virgins in the temple with the oil and you know. Okay, we'll dispense with most of the silliness and get right to the topic at hand. First, we'll hear from Todd Compton. He was once in the Santa Monica First Ward with me, and right before I could have had any sort of ecclesiastical authority over him, he left. He's, what? I do, I have a little. And now that I've gotten just a little, I will begin exercising unrighteous dominion. It will be my sad experience. Sad counselor in the elder's form. But over my fiefdom I will reign in terror. He's a author and a historian, and we just, my friend Sam and I used to like to call him Todd, straight out of Compton. Wow, people! I didn't know how that room would, or how that joke would play in this room. I'm glad some people got that. I'd say the Sunstone crowd don't know about early '90s gangster rap. And their respondent today will be Robert H. Briggs. He's from Fullerton. He's an attorney. He's an historian. And when Todd's done, we'll hear right from him, so as I will not disrupt the proceedings again. If there's time, we'll take questions. Take it away, Todd.
I told Matt, no jokes in the introduction. You see how obedient he is. In this session, I want to do something a little bit different, and that is not present a formal paper, but I wanted to read the story of Cohen Marr's experience of losing a child to apparent suicide. And, you know, for a number of reasons, but one is that I think sometimes we idealize historical figures and see them as larger in life and don't realize that they some of the typical problems that we face. And I don't know if any of you have ever known someone who committed suicide, but obviously it's a tragic, really difficult event. I know I had a friend who went on a mission, committed suicide on his mission, and I went to the funeral, and it's hard to imagine what the family went through. And this is one of the Helen Marr Kimball Whitney's journal is one of the few really good records of a suicide that we have in the Mormon historical record. And I find it her account of it fascinating because you just keep finding pieces of the puzzle. And you're trying to put it all together. And hopefully at the end of the day today we'll have, at least we'll know, well, we have all these pieces, they don't exactly fit, but it's really interesting to see all these pieces. And hopefully we'll be able to empathize with her and see her as a real person rather than, you know, as a pioneer, heroic figure. And she was a real person. And she faced problems such as dealing with marriage problems, health problems, financial problems, problems with children, children with psychological and physical. Just a background. She was the daughter of Heber C. Kimball, who was one of the larger-than-life pioneers in early church history. Brigham Young was kind of her unofficial uncle. He kind of served as uncle, even though technically he wasn't really a member of the family. So Helen Marr married Joseph Smith in Nauvoo at the age of 14. She was his youngest wife. And after Joseph Smith's death, Helen married into another prominent early Mormon, the Whitneys, as she married Horace K. Whitney for a time. She underwent many of the typical heroic experiences of most early Mormons, living in winter quarters, crossing the plains, helping to settle early Salt Lake City. And she lost 3 children during those events. She eventually had 11 children and lost 6 of them before her own death. And her husband, Horace, married 2 plural wives, though one died young. So she experienced practical wilderness living. Her parents died in 1867 and 1868, and this kind of began a slow decline in her social status. In 1884, her husband Horace died, so leaving her facing the financial and emotional challenges of widowhood. And so she had 6 living children when we start reading the diaries in 1886. 4 girls, Lily, Jen, Penty, and Plot, and 2 sons, the charismatic, brilliant Orson, who would later become an apostle and who was a very popular orator at that time, and the talented Charlie, who left a diary, which shows, like many teenagers, he was going through a difficult adolescence. And Ken Godfrey published a kind of a resume analysis of that diary, which Charlie kept when he was a teenager. It's one of the rare diaries we have by kids or teenagers. And it talks about the problems he had as a teenager, and we all have, you know, problems going through those years, and Charlie was no different. One of Helen Marr's daughters, Hendy, had married and moved away, but the rest of the kids were living at home. And Helen Marr was facing many health problems, and often her diary entries showed that she had depressed spirits. So in August 1886, Helen Marr and her brother Solomon decided to go visit northern Utah and Bear Lake in southern Idaho, where many sons and daughters of Heber C. Kimball had settled. Okay, Tom, how many wives and how many children did Heber C. Kimball have?
44 wives and 42
boys. I think that's... He's a descendant, by the way. One of the rare descendants of Heber C. So Helen kept a very full diary of those early days of the trip, and she was obviously enjoying herself immensely. Visit family and old friends. And on August 5th, she was in Meadowville, Bear Lake, Idaho. Now I'm going to start reading the diary. And Matt, you will... Tell me when I have 5 minutes left, right?
You'll get the hand signal.
Okay, this is the 4th, the day before. Was very tired after taking a light lunch, went to bed. Among the pleasures anticipated during our stay was a trip to some springs. I'm just reading this to give you an idea of what it's like before she gets the news. And I have spoken for the privilege of going to conference in an adjoining town. Hiram came in... Oh, this is funny. Hiram, this is one of her half-brothers, Kimball. Hiram came in late, asked his mother if she would get up at 3 o'clock a.m. and get his breakfast. There being a party going fishing and wanted him to go along. She said she would. So, I can't imagine my mom doing that. I asked if Saul was going. He said yes, late before I got to sleep. Thursday the 5th, 5th of August. All was astir at 3 o'clock, and as I was taking consolation to myself that I was not among the number to be routed and snuggled down to take another nap, when Saul came and informed me that my Charlie was very sick, had got the news in a letter from Bud Whitney. Bud Whitney was the oldest son of the other side of the family, of the other plural wives. So that's how Helen Marr got the news. Saul was her full brother, and he did not want to tell us, but he knew that Charlie had committed suicide, had killed himself, and he did not want to tell her. So he told her she was very sick, and they needed to go back to Salt Lake City. It shocked me so that I could hardly think, and I think when she's writing this entry, she doesn't know yet. It shocked me so that I could hardly think where my things were or get them ready to start. As Saul said, we'd have to get to Logan in time to take the 2 o'clock train or miss getting home that day. We took a light breakfast on the way by break of day. I had not been to see any of Father's folks, only Harriet and a few of the boys and two of their wives. This was really a cool time for this to happen. She was having so much fun, and she had health problems and rarely got out. Joseph and Jedediah, who called there, the air was cold and my hands numb, though I had Saul's stick gloves. The boys had been up most of the night. Saul, Golden, David, and Joshua. These are all half-brothers or half-brothers. Golden, Jacob, and Kimball. Getting horses and carriages. For the latter, one of them rode over to the Gap to get the consent of Joseph K., Sarah Ann's, Doss, and David, furnished the team. These are all half-brothers at home now. The former brought it to Logan, stopped twice to grease the carriage, and arrived at Newell's 30 minutes to 2 o'clock. Washed and dressed, ate a trifle only, were on the train quite a time before it started. We met Sister Finch and daughter who were going down to Brigham City. Two daughters of Luna Thatcher also came in going to Salt Lake. We were detained at Ogden over an hour in the heat, and the restaurant where we stayed was intense. Saul brought some lunch, and I was treated to some grapes by Miss Thatcher. Then an old man coming from the temple who turned out to be a relative by marriage of Harriet Sanders Kimball. He tells a little bit about himself. Just as we were to take the train, the Eastern train came in. Some very peculiar people came with it, Japanese. Okay, after waiting an hour and 30 minutes, we were again on the way to Salt Lake. Okay, so her next entry is Salt Lake City, Tuesday 10th, weakened in body and sad in heart. So in writing, she skipped those days, like half a week. And she writes, "Oh, what a change has been wrought in my house since I left it for the purpose of visiting at Bear Lake, then go to the temple in Logan to work and get renewed in body and in mind. Another earthly crop removed." And I'm going to return to what she writes there, but I want to tell this a little bit chronologically. So she continues to kind of reminisce about what happened. 1 week ago tomorrow, I returned from Meadowville Bay Lake. When at Kaysville, Saul, her favorite brother, saw Brother Henry Groh, who came onto the car, and thinking him more experienced than himself, Saul charged him to break to me the horrible news of my Charlie's death, of which he'd been able to keep from me by watchful care, telling everyone on the train as well as Newell's and Logan not to speak of it, his mother being on the train. And the papers were being read all around me, containing an account of the dreadful act, but which I'd had no thought of wanting to read. So in other words, there was an account in the Deseret News of Charlie's suicide. And it's very interesting. It's a very full account. They told the story in detail about how he had killed himself. And so all these people were reading that Deseret News, and Saul was terrified that Helen would see the death of her son's suicide. And he himself, he just cannot bear to tell her the news. And so there's this person, Brother Henry Groh, I don't know much about, but Saul asked Henry Groh to tell Helen the news. Brother Groh broke it to me as carefully as possible, but I insisted upon his telling me the whole truth when he said he did not think I'd find my boy alive. And he told me the facts and even more, adding a poison dart which pierced me deeper than death could do, if it came in any other common form. Okay, what does that mean? And he told her the news that Charlie had died, and then he added a poison dart. Okay, so we'll read more about Henry Groh later, but it's never explicit what that means. Okay, so I read a couple of stories about Charlie's death in the Deseret News, and that raises a couple of issues. Why would the Deseret News, which was a very, the people who wrote for it and ran it were very close friends of Helen Marr and her family, why would they publicize this suicide like this? And so I have a couple of answers. One is that it was more culturally accepted to write about suicide at that time. And I came to that conclusion after I read similar articles in the Deseret News. And it's very interesting, you know, in our culture, I would think they would play down the suicide angle, you know, say he was very sick or something like that. And but in Deseret News, a narrative of how it happened and making it very explicit that it was a suicide. Okay, so my second theory as to why the Deseret News would do this is it would be a way for the family to control the story. Okay. And Orson often wrote for the Deseret News, and so I think it's possible that Orson wrote those stories that we don't know. And I wrote a summary of those stories, and so I'm going to read from my summary. Charlie loved the theater, performed in the home dramatic group. He had a girlfriend. He was spending time with her. He worked in the furniture store of Henry Dinwiddie. Though Charlie was afflicted by nervous complaints, they had seemed minor. His co-workers noticed that his memory sometimes failed him, which was unusual for a Whitney, and occasionally he was afflicted with a severe case of catarrh, which evidently is sinusitis, which caused him terrible headaches. I talked with one who's had this affliction, and he says that if these sinus problems are not treated, they can really be extremely painful and incapacitating. So on the morning of the 4th, Charlie had worked at Dinwiddie's as usual. Then in the afternoon, he left the store in the care of a young boy, and he went all the time holding his head in agony. So evidently he had a terrible headache. He came in the house, greeted his sister Jenny, who was talking with a friend, then went up to his room. Then Jenny heard a pistol shot from upstairs. She and her friends rushed upstairs and found him lying on the floor of his room in his own blood in the throes of death. Then lay beside him, and there was a large bullet wound above his right ear. And all these graphic details are from the Deseret News. Jenny called the doctor, and when he arrived, Charlie was already gone. He was dead. According to the obituary, the scene at the house was heartrending. The members of the family were overwhelmed with grief. Okay, so finally, Helen Marr hears the story when she's on the train, and she writes, "I could not believe that Charlie was dead. It seemed like a dream that I must have done, but oh, it was a bitter reality, and in my silent agony, I wondered what I had done, or what I had left undone, or if I am doomed to suffer this, that I could know how to feel for others under like trials." So immediately, she's trying to grapple with this from a religious point of view. Is it something I left undone? Is it my fault? Or if I was doomed to suffer this, that I might know how to help others. "How I cried to the Lord to help me bear it, if needful, and acknowledge his hand in Charlie's taking his own life. I couldn't weep, but oh, the agonizing thought, how a boy like him could have given way. What could have brought him to commit such an act? Had all my prayers for his eternal salvation fallen to the ground unheeded?" Now I'm going to go back to what she wrote earlier. She wrote, "Another earthly prop removed. Why and wherefore is all unknown." And you can just imagine what it would be like to deal with this kind of experience. "Only to him who giveth and taketh away, blessed be his name. He knows my heart, and that I've asked for nothing so much as the eternal salvation of my children. That they should be left to do anything that would cut short their glory, he would take them to himself." But I think the idea there is, before they would do anything that would cause them to fall from grace, that God would take them to himself. "And that I have held them upon the altar, that nothing should stand between him and me, which I will love, whom I will love, but slay me." Okay, so she came, she was on the train, and people came to greet her. "We were driven to my home of wretchedness, and to my surprise, it was surrounded and filled with sympathetic and anxious friends. My children strove with all their might to be calm for my sake. As soon as I was quiet, Orson, Saul, and George administered to me. Saul anointed my head. He wept and could hardly speak. Orson then gave me a great blessing. Many wonderful things were pronounced upon my head. Orson had previously offered a prayer, and all present thought it was the greatest they had ever heard. The first thing he'd said when we were on the way from the depot was that Charlie was not accountable for the act, and he had gained this testimony by fasting and prayer. I told him if I could know this, I would never murmur. So the issue is, if he did it kind of in a moment of temporary insanity, then they could deal with the issue. You know, if he did it intentionally, then it was harder to deal with. Like, Mormons kind of accepted that was a sin, and it would be harder to deal with. And we still have that thing, that poison dart that Brother Grow told her, that we don't know what it is yet. I told Orson the stuff that Brother Grow had told me that he had heard from some man against Charlie. Orson said he knew Charlie was innocent, and he thought Brother Grow had little wisdom or grace to add needless suffering to my stricken heart. Saul felt the same and blamed himself for asking Grow to break the news to me. I told him not to blame him, as I believed it to be so, for it would help to lighten the blow. And if I could but know that Charlie was not guilty of this, or of putting an end to his earthly existence, I'd not mourn for him now. Okay, so they want to have her sleep that night away from home, but she refuses. I called at last, and the lounge was prepared for Saul to sleep in the room where Charlie was, and those who sat up stayed in the dining room. When on my couch alone, tears came to my relief, and I vented my anguish. How often I silently cried from the depths of my soul, "My God, my God, my God, why is this, and what have I done to merit so bitter a punishment at thy hand? Have mercy and help me to bear it and to kiss the rod. Oh, that I could, the boy was worthy to be among the sanctified. I would not utter a murmuring word." Okay, so that's her initial statement of how she received the news and dealt with her son's death. Now I want to read some later entries in her diary that kind of show how she's trying to come to terms with this. August 11th, which is like a week later. "The weather in Salt Lake terribly has one reason for my wanting to come away, as my health was failing. Every morning as thought of my loss and the facts flashed upon me, the feeling that came over me was like I was dissolving, each portion of my body separating, lasting longer every day till I came here." That's a very vivid expression of her grief. Okay, we had a family meeting a couple weeks later, and together, her family and the family of her plural wife. And Orson opened with prayer, then addressed us, and his teachings were sharp and to the point. He made a prophecy at the close that if we would turn over a new leaf and obey God, honor his priesthood, keep the word of wisdom, etc., we would be able to stop the destroyer from this time, etc. He continued to break over his laws and did not keep the Sabbath day holy, etc. We would have some worse than Charlie's death. And these things he prophesied in the name of Jesus Christ. So, kind of a judgmental take on that, Charlie's death, I think. Then he asked Bud, and he spoke very humble and was desirous of being more united in the future, that Charlie's death had set him to thinking of those things and how much more he had been united and associated with those outside of his family's father's family. So in this family meeting, they agreed to be more unified. Okay, August 31st. Okay, Helen Marr, and by the way, I hope you get this book and read it, because Helen Marr's journal is so wonderful, aside from anything I've done to help get it published. The journal itself is really wonderful, but one of the really interesting things about it is she keeps records of her dreams, and she tries to interpret her dreams. It's just very fascinating, both the dreams themselves and how she interprets them. And August 31st, "I am now free from pain in my back." That's very typical of her, all her symptoms of her health. "I was feeling sorrowful this morning and was looking for something in my diary written last year, and came a dream, dreamt the blank of October 1885, that, quote, Charlie was going to be gone 3 years. And the meaning is so thin that my heart was cheered at the thought that he has now gone on that journey. So she's seeing it in context of Charlie going on a journey that was planned. You know, she's seeing it in the context of what God has prepared, at least with that entry. Okay. September 14th, a friend of hers named Sister Frank comes and visits. And there's another example, characteristic of this diary. She not only talks about her own dreams, but she loves to record dreams of other people and try to figure out what they mean. Okay, so she writes this. Okay, this is Lulu Musser. And Lulu Musser was evidently Charlie's girlfriend. Afternoon, Lulu Musser came with a buggy and took me a long ride. She had had an interesting dream. Charlie was with her most of the night. She thought he had died and come to pay her a visit. She was happy with him, and one among other questions, she asked him if she could be his if she did not have her endowment, but he shook his head and said no. Okay. And one interesting thing is Helen Marr often had dreams of people who were members of her family who had died, and she kind of felt that he had returned and visited and spoken with her. So I'm sure she felt that Charlie had come and visited Lulu. He was happy, and there was such a happy, peaceful influence left with her that she felt as though it was a reality that he had been with her. I told her that I considered that the Lord had been very good and permitted his, Charlie's, spirit to visit her. It should be encouraging to her to pray and cling to the Lord. So his girlfriend she'd kind of left the church or something like that. So in this dream, Charlie comes back and tries to encourage her to get her endowment. On August 30th, 1886, Helen had preached to Lulu. Preached a long time, and Lulu had said, "Well, the one thing I can't accept about the church is polygamy." And Helen said, "Oh, that's the most important thing. And let me give you one of my pamphlets." And she's written two pamphlets in favor of polygamy. And so she looked at Lulu as someone, you know, she could work with and preach to. Okay, one last entry I want to read, which shows how the puzzle is not all together in one place. Okay, this is May 1887, which is about a year after. Okay, and Lulu comes and visits Helen Marr again. Lou Musser came to see me and, while talking, told me things concerning Charlie's death that convinced me that he shot himself purely by accident. Okay, which is how she would like to see it. So it isn't a sin, it's an accident. She said Brigham Young invited him to go to Camas, as he was going, and Charlie was feeling too sick to work and thought he would be better for it. 10 minutes before his death, he left Brigham Mary Whitney's yard, saying he'd go and pack up his duds. Brigham telling him he had better lay down a while. As Lou says, I believe he was intending to take along the pistol and had it in his hand. And he was either sitting on the old bedstead, which broke down, and he threw up his hands, or he was standing. And one of his faint, dizzy spells shook him, and he fell on the bedstead and naturally threw up his arms to save himself, and the pistol went off in the fall and into the upper part of the plastered wall. She said Charlie Burton, Dr. Benedict, and many more to whom she'd explained this matter were convinced that it was an accident and nothing more. The fact that he was talking 10 minutes before in a cheerful tone, which I'd never understood till tonight, he being Charlie, and came up to pack his things with the expectation of going with Brig for an out to benefit his health, is enough to prove that no other idea was in his head, and that has satisfied me, saying nothing of other strong proofs that such an act of self-destruction was never committed intentionally. His nature, his education, and religion forbade him doing it. And so that's a whole other perspective, isn't it? Which a whole year later. And my question is, why did Lulu wait until a year later to tell this story to Helen Marr? It's curious. You know, Charlie evidently left no suicide note, as we know. And of course, we only have the account of the suicide that was in the Deseret News. So that might have been the account that the family wanted presented to the public. But as far as we know, there is no suicide note. So it is possible that it was an accident. So, I hope, you know, as we experience this with Helen Ma, that we can come to see what she experienced, how she tried to deal with it through the gospel, and, you know, I hope it will help us empathize with her and empathize with others in our modern day who have had somewhat similar experiences. Thank you.
Do you like to stretch? A little bit?
By the way, Rob did not have a paper to work with. So, thank you very much, Rob, for agreeing to do this.
Yeah. And because I didn't have the paper, I'm going to go a little bit afield, and then I'm going to come back and apply some thoughts to Helen Marr and to the society and culture that she occupied. One of the most enjoyable histories that I have ever read is Barbara Tuchman's The Proud Tower, in which she describes in fascinating detail the thought world of Europe and America the 20 years before the First World War. And it is just a wonderful social, cultural, and intellectual history. My view of that period, and really thinking only of America, before World War I, was what an idyllic, and before reading her book, was what an idyllic age. What an age of peace. There had been no world wars. After reading the book, I thought, what an incredibly bellicose and militaristic age it was. And how did they avoid a world war for as long as they did, since they were all itching for a war? Well, anyway, she recreates this whole thought world of both Europe and America in the pre-World War era. And then going back to the time period that Todd is talking about, which is Mormonism in the last quarter of the 19th century, which is the crucible in which modern Mormonism that we know, was formed. And that is a fascinating era. And Helen Marr and her journal, and you know, you get so much into the interior of her mind. You know every thought she has because she is detailed in what she records. Looking into the past, we see both similarity and difference. We see similarity, and that allows us to identify with a figure in the past. But we see difference, and that's when our response is to say, the past was different. They did things differently back then. And I think that enough time has gone by. We are now 100 to 125 years from that. And our world has changed sufficiently that we ought to have a good social and cultural history of that period. If you stop and think the major event of that period was the anti-polygamy campaign. And if you'd like to know a little more about it, I'd recommend that you go to my session next hour. But anyway, so that was the overriding event. And because of that, beginning with B.H. Roberts and continuing on, what we mostly have of that period is political history, which a political and legal, and how the political and legal arena was, it had this enormous impact on the church and on the members of the church. And I think it would be a good idea if we had a good cultural studies, and I would probably start with Helen Marr because we know the interior of her mind so well, and I would suggest some of the other Latter-day Saint women of her generation, also some of the men, not so many of the men that it drowns out the women's voice, but try and get some voices from the Latter-day Saints that represent both the elite, the middle ranks, and the common man and woman. And then I would like to know about sort of the other side of the equation in Salt Lake City in Utah, and that is the Protestant brothers and sisters that also occupied Utah. Of course, they did not, the Mormons and the Protestants did not view one another as brothers and sisters. As a matter of fact, they were at least antagonists, if not outright enemies of one another. Mormonism at the time, probably more than either before or after, was viewed as a counter-Protestant or even an anti-Protestant religion. And it produced this awful conflict. And so you've got these men and women of Protestantism that are in Utah, part of the anti-polygamy campaign, and I'd like to know about them. I'd like to know, you know, what was their thought world? What were their motives? What were their hopes and dreams? And I'd like to have a human face put on them. I'm going to take a minute to think about the photographs that we see of the 19th century. And we look at both the Protestant women and the Mormon women. And I don't know about you, but I can't tell them apart. They all wear the same dour, straight-laced look. They all wear the dark dresses which extend to the neck, the wrists, and the ankles. And if you look at a group of one of them, it's hard to believe that one of these groups looked at the other and thought them lascivious and referred to them as lascivious wretches. And so when you look at a picture of that era, you think, okay, which are the lascivious ones? I can't tell. And then we should also consider that old nagging Protestant worry, which is somewhere, someplace, sometime, somebody is having fun. And so there was somebody that was about to be, that was interested in stamping out the fun that Mormons were apparently having. But again, when you look at the pictures, you know, who was having the fun and who was doing the stamping out? You really can't tell them apart because culturally and the way they dressed and so forth, you know, they all, in that sense, they shared the same world. They were very conservative in terms of dress. Nothing about their dress that I can see that distinguishes the one from the other. So I think it's a fascinating era. I think enough decades have passed that, and there's enough difference between them and us that it would be very illuminating to have a good study of that period, to look at both the Latter-day Saints and the Protestants. And I can't think of anybody who would be better to do it than Todd Compton because of his excellent judgment. And there's a lot of things I could say, but the thing that I see in dealing with controversial areas and controversial sources is he is just very good and very careful at adjudicating between these sources that differ so much. Thank you very much.
Yeah, we got 15 minutes. Yeah, do you want to do questions? Or
you can touch a little on the marriage of Jen Whitney, which is told in the title, but...
Oh, I'm sorry.
You know.
I began focusing on...
Well, we got a little time, you know.
But I'll tell you that story.
Start to deliver a little on the problem.
What happened was... well, it's better to read it.
As I told you, she had a number of these daughters who were not yet married, living at home. And one of them was Jen, who was actually the daughter who was there when Charlie committed suicide. All in all, she had 11 kids, and 6 of them died. So, so after Charlie's death, there was her son Orson, and then the 4 daughters. And the one daughter was married, Indy. Helen Marr had a friend named, in her diary, Mrs. Talbot. I haven't quite figured out her name yet. It was a non-Mormon. And as Robert mentions, it was a very interesting era because there was this deep, emotional, intense polarization between Mormons and non-Mormons. And so it's interesting that she had this non-Mormon friend. And Mrs. Talbot had a number of sons who tended to be minors. So Helen Marr's kids fraternized with him somewhat. Okay, and so this is, August 29th. So that's not that long after Charlie died. So this is the entry. My body was too feeble to walk the meeting. While we were at breakfast, I spoke to Jen upon the subject that I'd desired to for days. I told her I thought it was wrong for her to be going with Ed Talbot and fooling him along. When she assured me that she was not fooling him, underlined by Helen Marwick, and to my utter astonishment, she, in answering to my questions, acknowledged that they were engaged to each other. So this is the last thing that a good Mormon mother needs to hear, that her daughter is engaged to a non-Mormon, secretly engaged to a non-Mormon. And I got insight into how serious it was for a Mormon to be engaged to a non-Mormon in the book A Mormon Mother. She talked about how it was just not accepted within Mormon culture at all. If you're a good Mormon, you could not marry a non-Mormon. And so Helen Marr was super Orthodox, and so this was a huge problem with her. I was as much astonished at this, that they're engaged, as I was at the news of Charlie committing suicide. And I think she's serious when she says this. Never having an idea that her feelings could change so towards Ed, whom she had always looked up to as nothing but a boy. Okay, so then she goes into history. Ed had been interested in her before, and she thought that Jen had always kind of brushed him off. And all she knew about was Jen continually brushing Ed off. And she talks about that for a while. But it never entered my mind that she could ever come to like him. Only as a friend, until she told me the contrary Sunday morning. I asked her when the change came over her. She said she did not know. He asked her last Thursday, the evening they went home with Lyle Lewis. I was dumbfounded and heartbroken and returned to my room. There I prayed and wept the best part of the day to the Lord that he would have mercy on us. Help me to acknowledge his hand in this as well as other things. And to show me whether it was for punishment for Jen's disobedience or if it would turn out as blessing by Ed's joining this church and become, as Saul thinks, maybe he will, a savior to his father's house. So I'm not going to read the whole passage, but that's the start. And so Helen worked on her daughter, Jen, and Orson, who's, excellent, and he was bishop of the local ward, he worked on her, and they said, okay, we'll let him marry you if he agrees to join the church. And Ed evidently put his foot down and said, no, I'm not going to do that. But he does talk to Helen Marr, and he says, I'm sorry you feel this way, I've always admired you. And Saul comes to Helen Marr and he says, well, you know, Ed's a good boy. He's a very good boy, even if she's not Mormon, which doesn't really help Helen Marr much. And so she, you know, it's as much a crisis for her almost as Charlie's death was. And so finally, toward the end of the year, in December, Jen marries Ed. And but Helen Marr, as in that passage I read you, she kind of has two ways of looking at it. One is it's a total disaster, and she talks about the doom that people who marry outside the church will know. It's like you've lost your eternal salvation. On the other hand, sometimes she thinks, well, maybe this will be how Ed will join the church and bring the rest of his family to the church. So kind of that missionary spirit comes to the to her help to kind of come to terms with this. I think both in this case and in the case of the suicide, we see how her religion, how she looks at it, how it helps her come to terms with, you know, this stark tragedy that happens. Back to Salt Lake. But he was up in Montana at one point and got an opportunity to run a boarding house. So Jen was living with Helen still, so he sent home to Jen and he said, please come up, help me run this boarding house. And Jen wrote back a letter and she said, my mom helped his dad, I don't think I should leave her. I'm going to stay here. And so Ed came to terms with that. He was very upset, but came to terms with that. And then there was a financial panic and the mining business went bad, and Ed came home and kept getting these part-time jobs as a temporary police officer and so on. But he lived at home with Helen Marr, and so it was Jen and Ed who lived with Helen Marr, and otherwise she would have been all alone as a widow, which would have been very, very difficult for her. And if you read this book, you'll see gradually she comes to warm up to Ed. You know, he's the one there to help her. And Jen has kids, and she kind of helps raise the kids, her granddaughters, her Talbot granddaughters. As far as I know, Ed never did join the church. So that's that story. These two blows that Helen Marr faced in 1886. So, any other questions?
Yeah. What happened to the children? Were they brought up to LDS, or were they out of the church?
The Talbot kids?
Yeah.
You know, that's a branch of the family I have little knowledge about, which I suspect is because they did not remain members of the church. And so I don't have the records on that branch of the family. And I would have to learn more about them at some point. But so I suspect from the fact that we have very little genealogy about them, you know, very little family history, that they kind of, as branches of the family do, kind of wander off. Maybe they moved away, and we just don't have much knowledge about them. But I suspect that they didn't remain active in the church. He was older. In fact, he was the oldest of her surviving kids.
Uh, 1896.
She kept her diary till about a month before she died.
What was her response to the manifesto?
Her response to the manifesto when it happened was deafening in its silence. She, you know, arguably that's the most important historical event in Mormon history of that generation, you know, of that decade. And there was nothing about it in her diary. A little later, evidently what happened was church hierarchy had local leaders hold local meetings in their local wards and explain the manifesto to people. She refers to that, and then all she does is she says she goes to the Deseret News office and asks for the Deseret News that had the records of the manifesto. Beyond that, there's not much that she says about the manifesto.
Well,
You always wonder what she thought. And evidently, we owe to the research of Mike Quinn, evidently Orson Whitney courted a woman after the manifesto. And so like many other leading Mormons, he probably had the idea that they would continue surreptitiously practicing polygamy. And so Helen Marr might have felt that too. So she might not have felt that manifesto was as important as, in retrospect, we think it was.
What was personal news in his dad's deal with his grandfather about the tool being shown of Helen Marr and Joseph Smith? Things like that. I think that's
right. Manifesto. Referring to the marriage of Joseph Smith and Helen Marr, right.
Does she discuss that? I'm assuming she had looked at that differently.
No, her journals are about her daily life, but every now and then it comes up. The subject comes up, but it isn't like she, you know, wrote a history of it in her journals. But like, what would happen was people would come from out of town and come to Elaine Wells, who is one of the, you know, leading women of the church, and say, oh, we'd like to meet a plural wife, Mrs. Smith. And Emmeline Wells was one of the people, Helen Marr was one of the people Emmeline Wells would take to meet, you know, to say, okay, here's a plural wife, Joseph Smith.
Emmeline Wells?
Not of Joseph Smith. Right, yeah. And there were a few others who were still alive at the time who Emmeline could take to see. But there's a couple of accounts where RLDS people came into town, you know, and so the Mormons were trying to explain to them, oh yes, Joseph Smith did have plural wives. And so they would actually, you know, take people to meet these plural wives. Leah?
Wouldn't you say Orson was more of a favored person in the church because he was almost filled with them?
Yeah, I think...
I
think people in the church took that very seriously. In other words, Helen Marr was married eternally to Joseph Smith, not to Horace F. Whitney. And so according to Mormon belief, all of her kids would be sealed to Joseph Smith, not to Horace F. Whitney, for eternity. And so in other words, Orson Whitney was actually the son of Joseph Smith, you know, from the eternal perspective. And I think people like Joseph F. Smith...
He set that up. Orson did.
He did?
He knew he was going to be an apostle.
Yeah. Kind of...
In spite of believing in reincarnation.
Yeah, the Quorum of the Twelve wanted him to join earlier, and he had those issues with spiritualism. He was such a dynamic person, he was such a dynamic spirit, and there was that element of he was, you know, eternally, he was a son of Joseph Smith. So I think people like Joseph F. Smith took that very seriously. And
he was one of his promoters.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea when he joined? It was after the turn of the century. Yeah, after the turn of the century. I've got his death date here somewhere.
This is the reincarnation
part going on now. It's not funny. They believe that Joseph believed it.
He died in 1931, by the way.
31.
Yeah, 1931.
A comment back on Sapir and Rod. There is this huge gulf between the Mormons and the Gentiles, but there's one exception to that. When they split into Republican and Democrat parties, there are Mormons and Gentiles in both. And they're really trying to overcome some of that. And one of the ways is in the Salt Lake City Chamber of Commerce. And one of the main guys is a Jewish guy named Fred Simon. And it's amazing how much harmony is being developed in the political parties and in the Chamber of Commerce, and how much bitterness between the Republicans and Democrats among Mormons.
As you can read in his very fine book, Critical Deliverance, and I was just looking at that for some other reason, and it referred to course, Joseph F. Smith became a very firm Republican, but there were a number of Mormons who were very firm Democrats, and the leaders were worried that everyone, all the Mormons, would become Democrats. And Thatcher... Thatcher... What's Thatcher's first name?
Moses
Thatcher. He gave a talk where people said that he said that the origin of the Republican Party was Satan and the origin of the Democratic Party was Jesus Christ. Joseph F. Smith did not like that. But it shows how the Mormon leaders became polarized, became Democrat and Republican after the Manifesto. But it's a fascinating period in church history, and not covered as well as other periods. And even Leo deserted it. He's going back to pioneer stuff. Oh, good.
In my reincarnation. Yeah, I retired.
Did you have a comment, Rob?
No. That's our time. Thank you so much for coming. Congratulations to Todd as an extremely newlywed. How many days now?
3 weeks.
3 weeks he's been married. Congratulations to Todd.